It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Secretary Kerry says Russia has not taken single step to ease Ukraine crisis, and Syrian airstrikes killed dozens at Aleppo Market. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Russia is stoking instability in Ukraine, and the Obama administration will impose additional sanctions against Moscow if it does not keep promises made last week to help de-escalate the crisis. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports.
Secretary Kerry says the world has rightly judged that authorities in Kiev are working in good faith to de-escalate the crisis, while Moscow has put its faith in distraction, deception, and destabilization.
In plain sight, Russia continues to fund, coordinate, and fuel a heavily armed separatist movement in Donetsk. Meanwhile, Russian leaders are making increasingly outrageous claims to justify their action.
The head of Russia's lower house of parliament, Alexei Pushkov, says Russia has never and will never interfere directly in Ukrainian affairs. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Syrian government airstrikes killed at least 27 people and injured many others at a market near the northern city of Aleppo. Activist groups, including the Britain-based Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, says government jets killed or hit the crowded market in the town of Adareb, located in the Aleppo province, early Thursday. The strikes, the latest in the Syrian government's bombing campaign against rebel-held areas in Aleppo that began in December. Israel's security cabinet has decided to suspend peace negotiations with the Palestinians in response to a plan by Palestinian rival Fatah and Hamas to reconcile and form a unity government. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had earlier criticized the announcement, saying the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who represents Fatah, is complicating ongoing peace talks.
We're trying to relaunch the negotiations with the Palestinians. Every time we get to that point, Abu Mazen stacks on additional conditions, which he knows that Israel cannot give. So instead of moving into peace with Israel, he's moving into peace with Hamas. And he has to choose. Does he want peace with Hamas or peace with Israel? You can have one, but not the other.
Hamas's prime minister says he was not surprised by the Israeli response. An Afghan security guard has opened fire at a hospital in Kabul, killing three American doctors in the latest attack on foreigners in Afghanistan. Thursday's attack took place in a hospital run by the U.S.-based Christian charity Cure International. In a brief statement on Twitter, the U.S. Embassy said, "With great sadness, we can confirm that three Americans were killed in the attack on Cure Hospital." Afghan officials said a fourth American was wounded in the shooting. Afghan Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui said an investigation is underway.
One of the police security guard opened fire on three foreign nationals. Three of them have been killed. There was one another foreign national who was wounded in the incident. So the wounded has been taken to the hospital, and the attacker is also apprehended by the police. So we are going to investigate to find out about the motives of this attack.
It is unclear whether the Taliban is responsible for the shooting. The United Nations mission in South Sudan says four people were wounded Thursday when gunmen attacked barges bringing supplies to a UN base. This is the second time this month UN operations in South Sudan have been targeted following a mob attack on a UN base in the town of Bor, April 18th. U.S. officials are sounding the alarm over what they call humanitarian catastrophes in Central African Republic and South Sudan, neighboring African nations that in the past year have been ripped apart by political turmoil and then descended into bloody conflicts. The tragedies in the two nations could not be more different. In the Central African Republic, long troubled by civil strife and coups, Muslim rebels toppled the former president last year. In doing so, they unleashed chaos that turned into deadly violence between Muslims and Christians. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, the 25th day of April, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan to free four alleged coup plotters today, Friday, after dropping charges against them.
You say of the case is not dropping the charges, is that the case is frozen and the people accused can be released indefinitely, and this was done on the interest of peace.
Attorney Wek Attorney's spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. The United Nations condemns an attack on barges bringing food and supplies to South Sudan. The South African Broadcasting Corporation is accused of bias after it rejects a political advertisement. And the U.S. anti-apartheid movement remembers 20 years after the end of apartheid.
They went out there to put themselves on the line to say, look, if South Africans could be beaten and jailed, the least we could do is go out there and experience some discomfort ourselves.
Ron Dellum is a former U.S. congressman. Releasing abducted schoolgirls from Boko Haram is Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan's top priority. Today is World Malaria Day, as the WHO calls for investment in controlling the disease. And scientists decode the testy genome. Those stories plus Mark Oman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan will today, Friday, release all political detainees accused of plotting to overthrow President Salva Kiir's government after the administration dropped the charges against them. Presidential spokesman Atene Wek Atene says the decision is part of a bid to expedite peace negotiations between representatives of the government and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. Atene tells reporter Peter Clotty that President Salva Kiir will consider an official pardon of the detainees.
The government has decided to stay in the case because these are the powers given to Minister of Justice under what is called Criminal Procedures Act of 2008, that the Minister of Justice can order a stay of the case. The stay of the case is not dropping the charges, is that the case is frozen, okay, and the people accused can be released indefinitely. And this was done on the interest of peace. The international community has been calling, and we have seen as government that let us try to release these people if it can give chance for peace to come.
What does this mean to the ongoing negotiations and especially to the ongoing conflict that has left thousands of people dead and hundreds of thousands displaced from their homes?
What it means, it is actually significant that the issue of the four main suspects of coup attempts cannot be used by any party as a ploy to stay away from negotiating in good faith. So it will not remain as another condition negotiation. So it will be very significant because it will reach, the gap between the two parties that are negotiating peace in Addis Ababa.
Why take the step now when the government had opportunities to release them in order not to bring the country to the brink of war? Why now, after a lot of bloodshed has happened, why take the decision now?
The reason of war has not been because these people were detained. The war started on the 15th of December. The coup attempt failed, and by 16, already South Sudan was fighting. So they were arrested on the basis of the failed coup attempt. It wasn't the reason of the war. There were reasons for that war. So this is the right time now for the government to release them, for the interest of peace, because the government of South Sudan is looking to achieve peace.
President Kiir has said he has forgiven them. Does that mean that he is going to grant them amnesty?
Yes, they are now free. They are going to be free tomorrow. And for the President Kiir to pardon them, that will be another estate, so that for them to be able to participate in any political activities in the country. But as far as their freedom is concerned, they will be free tomorrow.
Atene Wek Atene is South Sudan presidential spokesman. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Juba. The United Nations mission in South Sudan strongly condemned an attack on Thursday on a convoy of UN barges taking supplies to staff and displaced civilians in Malakal, Upper Nile State. Viewer's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
UN spokesman Farhan Haq told reporters the attack, which injured four crew members and peacekeepers, was unprovoked.
The barges came under small arms fire, and rocket-propelled grenades were also fired at the convoy of four vessels.
The UN mission has not yet identified the gunmen who attacked the barges as they made their way along the Nile River towards the UN base in Malakal. Both the Sudan People's Liberation Army and SPLA and opposition forces have denied responsibility for the attack and said their fighters were not present in the area. The United Nations said it received all necessary clearances from the government before the convoy set out 6 days ago. The UN Security Council has condemned two other recent acts in South Sudan, a massacre in Bentiu where more than 200 civilians were reportedly killed, and a mob attack on a UN base in Bor. The council has warned President Salva Kiir and his rival, former Vice President Riek Machar, that they must publicly state all attacks on civilians are unacceptable and hold perpetrators accountable. The council has said it is willing to take additional measures, which could include targeted sanctions on those sponsoring or encouraging unrest, should the violence continue. The council has also asked the UN Human Rights Office to investigate the massacre last week in Bentiu, where civilians were killed along religious and ethnic lines. Also Thursday, spokesman Haq said Secretary General Ban Ki-moon telephoned leaders in the regional bloc IGAD to express support for their efforts to bring South Sudan's government and rebel forces back to the negotiating table.
The Secretary General feels that the two parties need to be warned strongly of the consequences of their actions before the country descends into yet further violence.
The United Nations is sheltering 78,000 civilians at eight UN bases in Juba, Malakal, Bentiu, and Bor. Fighting between pro- and anti-government forces that erupted in South Sudan in mid-December has killed thousands and displaced more than 1 million South Sudanese. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
It's been 20 years since the end of apartheid in South Africa, one of the strongest protest movements outside South Africa to dismantle apartheid was in the United States during the 1980s. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports from Washington on how the American anti-apartheid effort played a pivotal role in bringing about change in South Africa.
Television news images of the violent struggles to end apartheid in South Africa captured the attention of Americans in the 1980s. They also galvanized support for the U.S. anti-apartheid movement.
Challenging apartheid in South Africa became a logical next place to go.
Former U.S. Congressman Ron Dellums was one of the leaders of the movement. He worked to expose the plight of South Africa's blacks, along with the injustices carried out by the white minority government. Dellums introduced anti-apartheid legislation in Congress, banning trade and investment in South Africa, and also led many demonstrations in which ordinary people and many celebrities were arrested.
They went out there to put themselves on the line to say, look, if South Africans could be beaten and jailed, the least we could do is go out there and experience some discomfort ourselves and be one with our sisters and brothers in the struggle to liberate them.
Howard Dotson, director of the Howard University Library, remembers protesting with his son outside the South African consulate in Atlanta.
The anti-apartheid activities in the United States actually reverberated around the world, leading other people to develop their own demonstration activities. And that probably was as critical to the overthrow of apartheid as anything else that was going on.
Students also protested on university campuses, calling on schools and corporations to get rid of their investments in South Africa. Nelson Mandela's granddaughter, Tukwini, says the U.S. anti-apartheid movement and others helped turn international opinion decisively against the apartheid regime.
My grandfather and the Walter Sisulus of this world really appreciated that because they realized that without the support outside, they wouldn't have been necessarily been successful in dismantling apartheid.
In 1986, Congress approved a law imposing tough U.S. economic sanctions against South Africa. President Ronald Reagan opposed the measure and vetoed it. But days later, lawmakers overrode his veto. Apartheid ended in 1994, and Nelson Mandela was elected South Africa's president. During a state visit to Washington, he thanked Americans for their support.
You have no idea how your involvement in the anti-apartheid struggle in our country actually helped to facilitate the transformation.
Dellum says there's no doubt the determination and sacrifice by so many in the U.S. anti-apartheid movement helped change the course of history in South Africa. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
15 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. The South African Broadcasting Corporation is being accused by the Opposition Economic Freedom Fighters, EEF Party, of employing apartheid-era media tactics after the state broadcaster rejected the party's political advertisement ahead of the May 7th general election. Julius Malema, leader of the EFF, says the rejection of his party's political advertisement will undermine the credibility of the upcoming vote. But Kaiser Kanyaho, spokesperson for the SABC, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the state broadcaster will air the advertisement if the EFF removes the incitement of violence from its message.
The EFF party presented an advert to the SABC and it was rejected. We wrote a letter back to them on the 16th of April, indicated that inside their ad, they've got a message that says to whoever is watching that they are saying they destroy e-tolls physically. And we said that this is against the CASA regulations, which prohibits any advertising that incites people to violence or any criminal activity. That is why, in the main, we said we are not going to be able to do that advert.
Some people are saying that the SABC cannot arbitrarily take that decision because if it does, it is infringing of the freedom of speech of the EFF party as enshrined in South Africa's constitution. What do you say to that?
Those people are very wrong because there are regulations that are not even SABC regulations that are governing the political advertising during the election period. And these are the regulations that have been agreed to by all the parties. Because in South Africa, you are not allowed, you might have freedom of expression, but you are not allowed to then use it to incite people to fight each other because that is not acceptable. Or you cannot use advertising to incite people to do a criminal activity.
The leader of the EFF, Malema, is accusing the SABC, and this is the quote. He said, once you suppress the people contesting elections, it means you are not ready to give us free and fair elections because unfair coverage leads to unfair elections. And he attributed this to the same apartheid system used to discredit or not use the messages of the ANC. What is your response to that?
I don't see how the ANC can be involved in this. They know the rules. They decided to put words like that in an advert, and we are applying the rules.
Kaiser Kanyaho is the spokesman for the South African Broadcasting Corporation. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Bloemfontein. Frustration and anger continue to grow in northern Nigeria's Borno state, where around 200 girls are still missing after being abducted from their boarding school last week. Human Rights Watch Nigeria researcher Mausi Shegun tells Ricky Shryak that the Nigerian group Boko Haram is believed to be behind the abduction.
The sheer number of girls and women being taken seems to be increasing. What I can perceive is happening with Boko Haram is that the group is now very much on the move. In the past, the wives and their children used to be left behind in their towns or in their residence, wherever they were living. But that obviously is no longer safe because they were being arrested, because Boko Haram itself, its members themselves are being hunted. And so they're having to move from place to place. Obviously, it's practically not possible to keep moving their family if they still have any family that shows allegiance to them. And so clearly there is a need for whatever services their wives were providing for them, domestic chores, sexual services, and all of that. And now it is getting worse. Earlier this year in Konduga, where a school had been attacked, at least 25 girls were taken. Again, there was another attack in Yobe State, where it was a co-educational institution. So the boys and the young men in the school had been slaughtered, while some of the girls, that number has never really been established. were taken.
And the women who have escaped in the past, did they say they were held in the Sambisa forest, as it's believed that these girls are being held in that forest?
Yeah, some of the raids that security forces carried out with civilian JTF, that's the local vigilance group, had been in Sambisa forest, and some girls had been rescued from the camps that were dismantled at that time. But the forest is rather vast, and a lot of the areas are really sparsely populated by human beings, but some of the camps in that forest still exist as we understand it today.
Mausi Shegun is the Nigeria researcher for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Abuja. The World Health Organization says investing in malaria control is a good health policy and makes good economic sense. In marking World Malaria Day today, April 25th, the WHO says the battle against this preventable and treatable disease can be won with increased financial support. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Great progress is being made in controlling malaria, and the World Health Organization thinks now is the time to capitalize on this success. John Reeder, the acting director of the WHO's Global Malaria Program, says international funding for malaria control has increased from $100 million in 2000 to $1.94 billion in 2012. He tells VOA that during that time, malaria death rates have decreased 42% globally and 49% in Africa. He says more than 3 million children's lives have been saved.
So clearly, ramping up investment in malaria can work and does work. And we've seen things like the vast expansion of bed net programs. You know, over the last couple of years, it's gone from 70 million nets that went out in 2012 to 136 million last year, and this year there's going to be somewhere in the region of 200 million nets put out there.
Despite this progress, malaria remains a worldwide scourge, especially in Africa. WHO figures show 207 million cases of malaria, including 627,000 deaths. The UN Health Agency says 90% of these deaths have occurred among children under five in sub-Saharan Africa. WHO notes 80% of malaria cases are found in 18 African countries, with Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo accounting for half of those cases. It says malaria disproportionately affects the poor and badly affects African economies. It estimates Africa loses $12 billion each year in lost productivity. It says the disease places a heavy burden on national health systems, accounting for as much as 40% of public health expenditure in some countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Scientists have mapped the genetic code of the tsetse fly, the insect responsible for African sleeping sickness. They say the findings could lead to better repellents and boost vaccine research. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization says African sleeping sickness occurs in 36 sub-Saharan countries. The bite of the tsetse fly transmits parasites that could eventually reach the central nervous system, causing confusion, sensory problems, and poor coordination. It also disrupts the sleep cycle, giving the disease its name. The WHO says drug treatment is complex, but without it, the disease is usually fatal. Serap Aksoy is a professor of epidemiology of microbial diseases at the Yale School of Public Health. She and her colleagues in the U.S., Africa, and elsewhere began searching the tsetse fly's DNA for its genetic code 10 years ago.
The genetic code is the blueprint of the fly that is responsible for making all the proteins that are involved in all of its functions, essentially. They're basically the part that an organism is made from.
African sleeping sickness is the name given when the disease affects people. When found in animals, it's called nagana.
Sleeping sickness, along with Nagana, have hindered public health and development of agriculture in Africa for centuries. So we're really excited that this will be a breakthrough for control.
The genome could help researchers better understand just how functions within the tsetse fly work.
These included, for example, olfaction, which determines smell, what we call gustation, which is taste, vision, reproduction, digestion, blood feeding, immunity, and symbiosis. And as we decoded the genome, we particularly look for proteins involved in these processes.
Axoy says it's not clear whether the research could lead to better treatment drugs, but she says the information could help vaccine development. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with boxing. Nigeria's Helen Joseph challenges the Dominican Republic's IBF Women's Featherweight Champion Diana Santana in a title fight in Accra, Ghana today, Friday. Joseph is the only African in the IBF female boxing rankings. Turning to football, FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria play Benin as hosts Togo tackle Mali in the semifinals at the West Africa Football Union WAFU B Under-17 tournament in Lome today, Friday. The tournament is being used by the region as preparation for the African Under-17 Championship qualifiers. In Italy, Zambia's Under-17 team play Israel at the start of their group campaign at the Del Nazioni tournament in Gradizo de Isozo tomorrow, Saturday. The Zambians are the only Africans in the 12-nation contest and will play Brazil and hosts Italy in the other group ties. Meanwhile, Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa welcomes South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs as Morocco's Difa Hassani Jadida hosts Egypt's El Ahly in Orange Africa Confederations Cup action tomorrow, Saturday. Tunisia's Zertin plays Zambia's Nkana, while in an all-Malian affair, Joliba face AS Real de Bamako. Elsewhere, Angola's Petro Atletico encounter Cameroon's Cotton Sport. Ghana's Mediama play Congo Brazzaville's AC Leopards. Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel engage Guinea's Horoya, and Nigeria's Bayelsa face Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports. In Egypt, the draws for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers take place in Cairo on Sunday. Preliminary round ties take place in July, with the main group qualifiers expected to run from September to November. Meanwhile, Uganda's world marathon champion Stephen Kiprotich is favored to emerge Nile Special Uganda Sports Press Association USPA Sports Personality of the Year at the award gala in Kampala tomorrow, Saturday. Kenya's world and Olympics 3,000-meter steeplechase champion Ezekiel Kemboi is a special guest at the annual function. Finally, Athletics Federation of Nigeria staged their second Golden League meeting at the University of Ilorin in Kwara State, Southwest Nigeria tomorrow, Saturday. Home-based Nigerian athletes who have been in residential training since last year are vying for the qualifying standards for the British Commonwealth Games and the Africa Senior Athletics Championships later this year. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, April 25th.
With the observation of this year's World Malaria Day, I wish to call on the World Health Organization to intensify the research for vaccination against malaria and also produce and distribute mosquito treated nets to the vulnerable Africans that are dying from malaria attacks daily. I am Clint John Michelle in Obane Kustruk, Obudu Katu Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment. And that's it for this Friday, April 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you a very good weekend.
Hello, Africa. This is Sunday Shomari, new host of our lighthearted program, Inquiry. Did I say Inquiry? Well, starting Monday, April 28th, Inquiry, we also have a new name. Let's Talk. That's right. Let's Talk will be the new name of our program. So for a show filled with interviews, banters, music, and a whole lot of laughter, join Let's Talk with Sunday Shomari, Mondays starting April 28th, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
And the baller,